Welcome to another edition of the Omaha Bar Association Bar Talk Podcast. I'm Dave Summers, Executive Director of the Omaha Bar Association. I'm here today with Lauren Misak-Vargas, the Executive Director of the Education Rights Council. We are in the awesome, is it Community Engagement Center? Is that
the name? The Barbara White's Community Engagement Center. Yeah. So it's a space that is for nonprofits or for community leaders or government leaders to kind of come here, and it's like free community space. Our office is based out of here, which is awesome, but it's on UNO's campus, which is super unique. So you get access to students and kind of, you know, that culture.
And there is an event space that's wonderful for if you're doing an educational, you know, a CLE, you can't charge for it. I think there's like some sort of restriction on that, but there is space here to have a town hall event, have an educational event on UNO's campus. They'll rent it to you for free. And so it's a great center here in the middle, the heart of Omaha.
Yeah, everybody should take advantage of it if you have an opportunity to come. It's a great space.
Yeah. So Lauren, you are not a native Nebraskan, Omaha.
No, I'm not. I know. Are you going to shame me?
No, you're. Okay. I'm not from here. I'm not from here either. And this is a few years old. The stat of 50% of the young professionals in Omaha are not from here. So we make up part of that 50% that's not from here. So give the listeners some sense of your early years and what got you to law school and here in Nebraska?
Yeah. So I guess here in Nebraska, my parents were both raised in Nebraska. Okay. So I have a very large extended family that all lives here. So it wasn't, even though I wasn't raised here, it wasn't unfamiliar. I spent a lot of my summers and so forth here. But how I formed ERC and kind of decided to go to law school, I actually was a school teacher. So I taught in New York City in the Bronx, and I taught special education, what's called like self-contained. And I did it through a program called Teach for America, which is a national nonprofit organization that, especially during the turn of like 2007, when I graduated, was trying to find kind of the best and the brightest and place them into educational settings. And their goal is for alumni to either stay in education or to continue with what your experience was in the classroom and make sure that you're making a difference on behalf of the students that you had. So that's kind of their grandiose mission. And so I left undergrad and went to New York and became a teacher. And in that experience, I learned a lot. Obviously, you do from living in New York and not being from New York City, but also being in the Bronx and working with children who are living in poverty and who oftentimes don't speak English or are newly immigrants to the United States. I think that a lot of teachers will tell you this, but I think I learned probably more than they taught, than I probably taught them. But it was a unbelievable experience. But what I also learned as part of that process is a lot of my students were not always given the best of opportunities. And maybe even though they had disabilities or had special education needs, they weren't held to the highest of standards. And so when I started to ask questions like, hey, you know, Barbara or whatever is reading on sixth grade reading level. Why is she in this special education classroom? Like, can't we, you know, move her into another classroom, or, you know, this child needs, you know, something else. I was kind of told to kind of sit down and shut up. Right. And I didn't know the law. I didn't understand. Let the professionals do that. And so after being in the education setting for, I worked, ended up ultimately being a teacher coach with Teach for America for several years. So being in that space for approximately like 6 years, I was like, you know what? I'm ready to be that person who's making those decisions and understand it better. Because what I found after getting a master's in education and so forth is, we kind of touch a little on, you know, what are the requirements of what's called an individualized education plan or an evaluation, or, you know, what are those things, but not really what the law is. And honestly, as an educator, without understanding the law, you then can't advocate as well for your students.
Yeah. And so you spent 2 years or 3 years in the classroom, then like 2 or 3 years as a coach?
Correct. Okay. Yeah.
And that experience, I mean, it is the best of the best. You must have rocked it out in undergrad, because I remember it was like, it's the 1% of the 1%, like yeah. Valedictorians apply only for Teach for America, and New York City is one of the top locations to be sent. So, that process, when you are a teacher and you're being told, don't worry about it, right? Just keep doing what we're telling you to do. Even if you see that the teachers or the students struggling, is that something that you found is not just a New York City problem, but something that you found here in Nebraska and elsewhere, that there's really that not, there's not really an effort to understand where the students are at, and those individualized education plans aren't as widely used as they should be?
Yeah, I think in regards to kind of educators, especially teachers, kind of being told to like, let the district handle it and you sit down. Yeah. I think that's a common theme yeah. nationally.
Yeah.
And I saw that not only with working with Teach for America, but when I actually went to law school, my intention was to do education law. Mm-hmm. And when I came to, the reason I came to Nebraska is I have family here. Mm-hmm. And the individual I was dating now, my husband, was like, yeah, I don't want to go to California, where I was from originally. He's like, I really like Nebraska. I'm like, okay, like, let's do it, right? Yeah. So went to Creighton. And when I started to try to find people who were doing this, this is actually one of the most litigated areas of law. But in Nebraska, the majority of people who are doing education law are representing districts.
Right.
They actually aren't representing families, which is uncommon in other states. Actually, you have more advocates or attorneys who are litigating on behalf of families. Mm-hmm. And so I really didn't have a space to land, mm-hmm. right? Like
right,
in
right.
that area. Like I had met with district attorneys and in terms of like people who work for districts and had kind of chatted with them, but that really wasn't where my passion was.
Right.
And so I found myself as a public defender. And so I worked in the Douglas County Public Defender's Office under Tom Riley, which was probably one of the most fortunate experiences I've ever had. If anybody's ever seen him practice, if anybody's ever worked with him, they know that he's a remarkable attorney, remarkable human. And I had the opportunity to learn how to litigate.
Yeah.
And so doing, you know, criminal law, but in particular, kind of having a niche in juvenile law, I started to see this huge overlap of education needs that also overlapped with criminal cases.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've ever heard of like that school to prison pipeline.
Sure.
Right?
Right.
In Nebraska, especially at the time when I moved here over a decade ago, wasn't really discussed, but it was something, especially on the East and West Coast, that was talked about, that schools were kind of putting the issue, children, maybe truancy and so forth, was being placed on the courts mm-hmm. instead of being processed and dealt with through the school system.
Right.
And I think any juvenile practitioner would agree with that, especially after truancy laws came to be, that kids were being criminalized for things that maybe should have been the obligation of the district. Not always, but a lot of times. And so what I found in my practice as a juvenile attorney is that, or public defender in that world, not only in juvenile court, but also in county and district court, was that nobody understood what the education laws were. So judges are ordering kids to go to school, but then we're getting evaluations saying a child's at a 70 IQ. All we can do is really notify the school district, but there's this huge gap in between what is actually happening for those students.
Yeah.
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating that the legal community here in Nebraska really didn't have a plaintiff side or a student family side represented. They had the school districts, but it was general. And I practiced as a solo. Mm-hmm. I did some education law, and you know, families would come to me and say, my kid's being suspended, and this is arbitrary. They don't suspend people that aren't the same color as we are, or you know, just because he's a male, and so they're going to punish or suspend a male student more than a female student. There's this arbitrariness to it. Can you bring a lawsuit, or at least stand up and help us fight the district on this expulsion suspension? And I looked around and I could not find, and this was about, 12 years ago. And really there wasn't anybody. And so I can second that. It never made sense to me that there wasn't anybody doing it. I always go to like the business model, like does this make sense for somebody practicing it? And sure, there are remedies that can pay bills, and there are definitely families out there that are willing to spend money to hire an attorney. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's the state's obligation to actually pay that attorney in certain circumstances to essentially allow these children to be treated fairly and not be, willy-nilly laying the rules for different people. And we know if you get suspended from school, if you get expelled and have to go find an alternative school situation, that can be so detrimental down the way for that person, that child, as they grow into a young adult and adults down the way. So the long-term effects, if we don't help these kids, is huge.
Well, and I think that it's not something that obviously affects vulnerable children, right? Children who are in poverty, children of color, obviously, but it really doesn't, it transcends socioeconomic class. I think this is such a niche area that, I have doctors call me, lawyers, friends that will call and say, hey, can you help us like navigate this? Because you think that you understand how this is going to play out, but really it's so nuanced. And I think that that's why people stop from, hey, this could be a really good practice area, and then they stop because it is quite complicated. And I think with COVID, it's only gotten worse. Like the amount of children that need assistance and help, like especially from depression, trauma, anxiety is so high. Please, it's high amongst adults, right? It's high amongst us all. So, but they do need extra support. So I was really fortunate in my time to find my business partner, Elizabeth Einen-Kokerda, who had worked for over 20 years in education law representing a district, had retired from her firm and decided to start practicing, for higher end clients doing this work as an education lawyer. She was pretty much the only one that really understood, as you said, the remedies, how to make a business model out of it. And so originally I met with her more as a mentor, like, hey, kind of teach me about this. What does this look like? And then I was sharing with her what I was seeing with the students that I was representing, the kids that I was representing. And oftentimes it felt unjust. It felt wrong for, one child in particular, because of their color of their skin or because of their disability, to be suspended when there actually are protections around that by law. But I didn't know how to argue for those, like in the court. The court, when I did start to learn, tried to argue some of those in a trial, for instance. You're having to teach the judge alongside with you. And so that was complicated. It was difficult. And obviously not every county attorney wants to sit there while you're, giving case law and case law. So that wasn't the most effective way, I guess, is my point. And so Elizabeth and I really started to think, okay, well, what can we do to help this population of students in Nebraska? And that's how we collectively started Education Rights Council. And so I really did it as a hobby. Hobby is a strong word. I think that I did it as it's a passion project. Every Saturday and Sunday prior to having kids, Elizabeth and I would work on it. We would work on it for hours. And initially it was about just the representation piece, but it's really transformed into something completely different than I think that we even expected it to do because of the need. Mm-hmm. And because not just families who are vulnerable, but all of Nebraska, judges included and attorneys, are starting to say, oh, I can see how this affects my practice.
Right. Mm-hmm. And one thing you mentioned there that I think is important is having issues, having developmental issues, having, depression, anxiety, things that are identified as affecting one's ability to learn, to be in that atmosphere. I think there's more of an understanding of that being an issue writ large, right? For adults, for kids and everything like that. But we haven't necessarily seen as much of an adjustment in the educational systems out there. Certainly during the pandemic and Zoom, mm-hmm. and now I think we're two grades behind on reading and grade and a half behind on math,
mm-hmm.
just from Zoom pandemic learning experiences. But this taking the science and understanding better where kids are at and how they need to have different ways of learning than we've had before. I mean, there's just so much more data and I think understanding, but necessarily the policies haven't changed, the systems haven't changed.
Right? Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean, these laws were created, well, the majority of them. 504 is a Civil Rights Act that was essentially created in the 70s. And so was IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is an education-based law. And those have really been unaltered since. Obviously, case law has driven what the interpretation of the laws are, but the law itself outside of case law hasn't been altered by Congress or anything of that nature. And then ADA, which happened in 1990s, I think people still don't understand, right? I mean, it seems kind of odd to probably you or I, like it seems like it's always been commonplace, but it really hasn't been. And so especially when you get into greater Nebraska and you're talking about ADA laws and what needs to happen for children, I mean, I have empathy for districts, right? There is not, it's not completely fully funded. Special education isn't completely funded by the states or even by the federal government. It is a pain point, right? A sticking point. However, there is money out there. There is an obligation. And so just like anything, for instance, in a criminal case, just because you don't have money to pay a public defender doesn't mean that you don't get one, right? Same thing here, except it's not necessarily counsel. It doesn't mean that you don't have to follow these obligations. And that's what we kind of have seen happening, is that maybe because of Nebraska NICE, there isn't that sense of accountability to the student. And I think that COVID has been a catalyst for that even more so. And again, I have empathy for districts. I think staffing is hard and so forth. But to say that that was something that was happening only because of COVID, I think is, if you look at studies and if you look at the data, would be a farce. I think that you really have to see this has been something that's been happening a long time. Teachers haven't been treated or compensated appropriately. They weren't going to stay in the profession for multitudes of reasons, and COVID really was that catalyst. And so, but still, those obligations don't just go away.
Yeah.
They don't go away when a child's detained either. You still have to provide those. And so are those happening for your student or for your kid, your juvenile who's in prison? That's a question I would ask to other attorneys, because I would probably say it's probably not, but those obligations still exist.
Yeah, that's you make a good point. And I guess I don't even know the answer. So if you're a juvenile that's being detained, what sort of education opportunities do you have while you're in detention?
It obviously depends on what the detention facility is like offering. There's something called Rural 18 Schools here. You can also, like Lancaster, for instance, actually brings in Lincoln Public Schools, and they run a school outside of their detention facility. But what I will say is that any child who has a disability or is suspected of having a disability, the district has to provide those services to those children. And so if you have a child who needs speech, for instance, has a lisp, if they aren't receiving speech and they're sitting on a gun charge for several months in a detention facility, well, then they are owed compensation, right, for that.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Compensatory ed.
Sure. And this going down a little bit of a rabbit hole here, but
yeah.
New York City specifically, the reading curriculum, and I just heard about this, how they went away from phonics, and now the data's in, phonics is the better way. So they're going back to.
Yeah, I think that there was. So there was a, now we're really going down a rabbit hole, but there was definitely a transition, probably at the time that I was a teacher. Lucy Calkins was an individual who really believed in, oh, now I'm going to forget the word right now. But
yeah, I'm forgetting it too,
It starts with a B, I think. Anyway, but essentially it was like holistic learning, right? And it was about children they'll ultimately learn how to read by having exposure.
Yeah.
And so there was designated curriculum for that.
Right.
And they've kind of gotten away from that phonics instruction or phonemic awareness of things like Wilson or Gillingham, like, which is really kind of teaching how do you sound out words.
Right.
I was fortunate at the school that I taught at that I actually learned both. So balanced literacy, that's what it was.
Yeah.
So in terms of a balanced literacy approach, I also infused that. So I have always kind of believed in both aspects. But yeah, I think that is something still in Nebraska that's happening. Not a lot of schools teach phonics directly. And it is something, if you have kids and they're struggling to read, that's something that you probably should examine.
I mean, it's crazy to think of 20 years ago, 10 years ago, the lack of understanding of mm-hmm. maybe what we're doing. It felt good to have this balanced literacy approach where somebody's really excited about reading, you know, this type of book. And so they're reading all these books, but they're not really, the comprehension's not getting any better. They're not actually understanding a wider array of things and building the vocabulary, building their comprehension on a larger scale. And so this like independent learning balanced idea of the children teaching themselves in that environment.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that on some level we look at kids and we say they're resilient, right? You know, some people are really smart. Here's the IQ test. Here's mm-hmm. the, you know, gifted and talented program. And do you teach to, you know, the lowest understanding level? Do you teach to the moderate, middle, the high end? And there's just so much dynamic change opportunity out there. And it's one of those things I think we're losing kids to, from public school to, you know, home learning opportunities, private learning opportunities. But I think there's a really big chance for public schools to take this idea and show that they can be as flexible and better at it.
Yeah. And I think that, obviously, I think that public schools obviously are always going to be on the cusp of what is new, what's advanced, like what are new things, because they get to try it out and they have the opportunity to work on new curriculums with all children, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have to embrace all kids. And so the one positive thing that I will say, though, in terms of like that curriculum kind of component is if done correctly, you can differentiate your instruction, which now we're really getting down a rabbit hole. These attorneys are going to be like, what the hell are they talking about? Did this become an
education
thing?
If you have kids,
thing?
This is important.
Yeah. But like you can differentiate your curriculum as an educator to the different learning styles and different learning levels. And I'll tell you in my classroom, you know, I had a non-reader all the way. I taught sixth grade all the way to a sixth grade reader. And so let's say that we were doing a history lesson on Egypt, right? It was just as important for my non-reader to understand and grasp some of those, some of that information and some of that context, just as it was for my sixth grade reader. Now, my sixth grade reader might have been reading, you know, a novel about it, and my, you know, non-reader was doing, you know, sight words to it, but it still doesn't mean that the content doesn't have to be there. So I do think the most important thing that I learned as an educator is that we do not want to, despite where children are, whether they have a disability or whether they are in poverty or whatever we think, right, whatever our implicit bias is around students, is to make sure that you're holding every child to high expectations. Mm-hmm. Because by not informing children of where they are, by not explaining to parents where their children are, you can't empower them to succeed. And all you are doing is pushing them down and making, for lack of a better word, having a God complex of, I know what's best and I'm not going to tell you. You're a 17-year-old and you're on a first grade reading level. How can that benefit that child? And all of us have had clients that are there that are struggling. And so, especially if you're in the juvenile court setting and you are a GAL or have an opportunity to work with students in this way, I think holding those high expectations and telling children where they really are can be actually a moment of empowerment. It doesn't have to be, oh, I'm so sorry, I want to shelter you from all the harm.
Right. And you did a good job of bringing it back to where we're at,
yeah.
Which is we have private practice attorneys listening saying,
mm-hmm.
I want to get involved in this field. how do I go about doing that? I'm a solo or small firm general practice attorney, and how do I get into helping students, families in this environment?
Yeah, so one of the things that with Education Rights Council that we decided, and I said that we kind of had changed lots of things. So we have several programs, but really our mission is to create systemic change by removing legal barriers for children to create educational equity. And so one of that aspect is training, right? Is really training the bar to understand this type of law, whether you are a solo practitioner, whether you have your own firm. We actually do contracts with private solo attorneys to teach them this. We will sit with you. It takes several cases sure. to understand what those remedies are and so forth, but we will work alongside of you to understand what this law is and pay you mm-hmm. while you're doing that. Because we, as attorneys, now I have a staff of about 10, but you know, prior to this, it was just Elizabeth and I.
Right.
And so I came on full time in 2020 amidst the pandemic. And so our goal really is for every attorney who especially works with children to understand just a little bit about this, to feel empowered to hold districts accountable or to understand the law. And so if this is an area, it can be a lucrative area. I promise you, I turn away clients all the time who would like to pay me. But our organization we do pro bono representation. And so we are only taking individuals who are 250% of poverty or below, or through court appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's obviously a unique niche area, but there are so many families out there who are seeking attorneys, and I don't have very many attorneys to send them to.
Mm-hmm. And the timeline is kind of, it's a sprint at the start of a case, right?
Correct.
Generally speaking, I mean, we're talking, a kid is looking at suspension, expulsion,
mm-hmm.
or they are really struggling. And so you kind of really have to do a lot of work right away.
Definitely. Okay. Especially with suspensions and expulsions, you have a very, very quick timeline within 5 to 10 days to make sure that you ask for a hearing, make sure that you are, if the child has a disability, asking for a manifestation determination, holding that manifestation determination, gathering that evidence, right? I think that's sometimes what's so scary to attorneys is not understanding that law. It's unlike county court or unlike some other things where you can kind of sit, understand the discovery, decide if you want to go to trial, right? You have several months in looking at what that looks like, even probably a divorce, you know, sometimes you have so much more time. Education law doesn't function like that. It does feel immediate. And the reason why it is immediate and why those timelines exist is because, yeah, to an attorney, 120 days doesn't seem that much. But for a child, for a student, 120 days is more than half of a school year. And so now you've taken out an entire opportunity for that child to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why these timelines exist. And that's why there's such speed.
And parents should feel empowered more to understand where their children are at, and asking like you said, ask the teacher, but also if there's a question, maybe go see a professional to understand if they're dealing with depression, anxiety, dyslexia, different things, right? I mean, don't just wait for the end result. If you're concerned about your child and maybe thinking that there needs to be some individualized learning done here, you have to go show that, like you said, that the child has those needs.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have a child, for instance, who you think is dyslexic and, you know, is maybe, let's say, in second grade and is not able to write, is struggling with phonics,
mm-hmm.
is struggling with kind of understanding. Now, by obligation, the school, under a law called Child Find, has the obligation, especially if you as a parent say, I have some real concerns,
mm-hmm.
and kind of lay them out.
Mm-hmm.
I want my child to be evaluated.
Yeah.
They have to provide you a consent
okay.
to evaluate you. They can't. Sometimes they'll say, oh, well, let's kind of sit on it. Let's think about this. As a parent, you should know that you can receive a consent, and they have 45 school days, 60 calendar days to complete the evaluation.
Yeah.
And it's not at your cost. So it is free to you. It's done by the district. But If you are thinking your child has anxiety or depression, let's say won't get out of bed, won't come to school, yes, it's always helpful to have a medical diagnosis as well, maybe to get some some assistance there. And this isn't just in public schools. If you have a child who's in a private school, in a parochial school, or even who is homeschooled, if you have a child who has concerns, learning concerns, and needs speech, needs OT, needs some supports, those obligations still exist with a public school. Now, how they're provided is dictated by the school, but they can be provided to you.
Okay. And I do want to talk policy.
Yeah.
If you can. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things here is individualized education plans within the school system they're in, or potentially going into special ed classes in that school, going to a school that provides a different sort of education model. And your husband, I believe,
yeah.
just changed the law here in Nebraska in terms of, because there had been this kind of just writ like, we're full up on our special education here. We don't have any more room.
Daniel Conrad.
Daniel, okay.
Yeah.
Daniel Conrad, it was her bill that got passed and signed in to her.
Yes. Okay. Yep. There was an emergency clause to it. It was part of a broader bill, 702, which had many education bills, but I think the bill that you're referencing is option enrollment.
Okay. Yeah. I guess my understanding was there was just, school districts that were saying we're full. We don't have any more, room for, special ed here, but they weren't actually providing information.
I'll kind of explain. So what was happening is in Nebraska, we, in the public school system, we actually have the opportunity for school choice. It's through an application called option enrollment. And you as a parent, if you, let's say, are in one district and you want your child to go to another, you can try to enroll or opt your child into a program. Prior to Daniel Conrad's law, what would happen is that the district could deny you pretty much for anything. And what ERC was seeing across the board was that, like, let's say you had a sibling, one with a disability and one without. Some districts would say, oh, yeah, we'll take this one, but we aren't going to take the other. And there was really no answer for that. There was no information about that. And so actually, this is something that ERC and Danielle had worked with Nebraska Department of Education. There had been a resolution. Is that what it, a legislative? I'm trying to think of what it's called. To do research, basically, okay, on this.
Sure.
I'm trying to think of what that is right now. I don't know why I'm losing my mind. But to do kind of some research on what the impact was.
Yeah.
And so they had done that previously and saw that it was impacting disproportionately children with disabilities.
Yeah.
And so now essentially what districts have to do is probably what they should have been doing, right? Is saying, hey, this is our capacity. And this is, you know, our capacity for special education. This is our capacity for any student on the front end.
Right.
So they have to dictate that. So then families, there's transparency there, right? It's not just, oh, we don't want your child, but we're going to take, you know, this other kid of, you know, means. So it's a way, and parents and Nebraskans should feel empowered by this, especially if you have a child, you know, with ADHD or autism and so forth, and you don't like the district that your child is going to go into, or that's not your preference, you can opt in and then now have some level of transparency as to if your child can be accepted into the district.
That's huge.
Yeah. I mean, having discrimination on its face is never great. And the Nebraska Department of Education also acknowledged that. And so I think the policy change is the right one, especially for a community like ours in Nebraska that values public schools, but also wants the opportunity for choice, right? This is why we have, especially in Douglas County, Millard, Westside, Ralston, OPS. I mean, I'm probably missing another one, right? Gretna. I mean, there's so many different school districts, even within this square mile, right? So obviously it's something that we appreciate, being able to jump from, you know, districts to districts. So this is a way for it to not be discriminatory.
Yeah. What does the next 3 years look like for ERC?
That's a really, really great question. one that I should do a strategic plan for. But ERC is really, we've grown significantly in, just in the past 3 years. So as I mentioned, Elizabeth and I were the only attorneys previously working. We now have five. I just started my other attorney just last week. And we are moving into kind of different areas of practice. I think one is working with traffic children. So children who are trafficked across the state of Nebraska, they have unique traumatic needs that overlap not only with special education law, but oftentimes the Title IX. And so looking at what does that intersection look like, especially for this population of children, we are looking at how can we train more of you, right? How can we work with the bar more effectively to make sure that all kids are represented in this area, that everybody has some interest or some knowledge about this to feel empowered by that, and gather more, you know, contract attorneys who want to learn this, who want to grow their practice, who are interested potentially in this area and want to get paid doing that. And then obviously policy right. is always an area in terms of just kind of like research and data. How are we pushing forward and making sure that we are creating systemic change, that we aren't just here. Of course, to be representing children is vital to our work because it helps us see what's happening on the ground. But we have to utilize that information to make sure that we are funneling it up and making broader change across the state.
If I went into OPS, let's say, one school district, and I said, what do you think about ERC? What do you think they, what do you think that they're, you know, a thorn in our side, or do you think they're saying they're keeping us accountable and that's good for everybody?
I think it's a mixed bag, right? I think it depends on the teacher, the person. What I will say is, as a former educator, one of my biggest passions is to make sure that the obligation isn't just falling on the teachers.
Yeah,
shoulders
right, right.
And that they aren't feeling criticized, that they aren't the ones who are feeling put out by the information. It's yes, they are part of the district, but it's the district's responsibility to make something happen. So if you have a child who you have tried everything for, and this has happened in many IEPs that I've had, where the district, the school has tried everything, the principal, everybody, we're having constant meetings. That setting just might not be appropriate for that child. And that is okay. It may need to be more restrictive. They may need more supports. And I've seen children who've gone to more restrictive settings become more successful, right? Because of their needs, and vice versa. Children who may not need to be in more restrictive settings, you know, going into less restrictive settings. We as an organization have really, last year we did a whole entire training series just for teachers and educators. And you asked where we're going the next 3 years. That's something we're trying to do is really reaching out to educators, to district employee, you know, for those on their own time, not on district time, but who want to learn more about this. We did a whole entire Saturday series, actually for the OEA, on this. And I think that, and then in juvenile courts too, we're seeing such a huge Lancaster County I'm meeting with here soon, Sarpy County. The judges are so interested in this because I feel like they have felt so long that their hands are tied behind their back, that they can't effectuate change for their, for the juveniles, that if that very last thing is that they still aren't going to school and that's what they got brought in, you know, or that's what their charge is, quote unquote, they have felt so unempowered to make change because they can't order, they don't have the jurisdiction to order a school district to do anything. So that's where I've seen the largest change from ERC. But yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. What I would say is that, you know, if you have questions, our intention always is on the side of children and to making sure that they have equitable outcomes. And if anybody has questions or concerns about that, I'm always down to have a conversation because I can always learn. And we're definitely not the silver bullet to anything. We have to have schools, teachers, everybody obviously implementing what happens. But this is just one area, one concept of education law that can really help a generation of children.
And, you know, even pulling back further, the, you know, children that have better opportunities for education, that become, you know, better young adults, that stay here in Nebraska, that fill the need of having those young people work in the positions that we need them to, you know, instead of always looking to wonderful people in New York City, in from California, that are in New York and then move here, or people from North Dakota that move here, building our talent base here through giving them the right education.
Huge. I mean, making sure that our students, especially, you know, the ones, especially this population of students who have lived through COVID, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. with that anxiety, that depression, that we are making sure that they are set up to become members of our society. I mean, that's ultimately what this is about. Yeah. That's why we have public education. Yeah. That's why we are ensuring, you know, that all members of our state can be productive members of our community. And so giving them all those opportunities, giving students all those opportunities to be able to do that, I think is fundamental. And right. it should be something that all of us as Nebraskans appreciate and want to accomplish.
Absolutely. Well, those are all my questions that I had, but I always open it up. Did I miss something
yeah.
that you want to talk about?
I don't think so.
And then we did do some rabbit holes, so we
yeah.
got some more.
You can edit some of those. I'm like, Lucy Poppins. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, that's, you must have listened to that podcast.
I did.
Yeah, that's why. I was like, yes, it's true. Yeah. Yeah, I worked at Teachers College for a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I remember the commercials. Hooked on Phonics works for me. Mm-hmm. You know? Turns
yeah.
out it does.
It turns out it really, really is important. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the time today.
Yeah, no
Appreciate
problem.
It. And we'll put links to ERC's website and then a little teaser, tickler for everybody. In October at the Nebraska State Bar annual meeting,
great.
We're going to have Elizabeth do a CLE there. So if you listen to this and want to learn some more, we're going to have that CLE at the State Bar annual meeting. So
perfect. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much. All right.
Thanks.